Hello, hello, and welcome to the podcast, Agroecology World, and this fifth episode. This is your host, Rob Clusa, a.k.a. Dr. K, who is making this podcast while on amazing world travels with my wife, Skye. This episode is the second of two episodes to introduce you to my meetings with outstanding practitioners and communities of the agroecology and sustainable food systems in the fascinating country of Aotearoa, or New Zealand. And as always, my intent for this podcast is to introduce you to actual folks and places so that you can learn from their ideas and experiences, keeping it informal but informative and light but enlightening. In this episode, we're going to continue our exploration of the science of agroecology. As described in the 2011 UN report, Agroecology and the Right to Food, agroecology provides the knowledge and methodology for the evolution of a long-term sustainable agriculture that can double food production in entire regions of the world within 10 years, while mitigating climate change and alleviating rural poverty. If you haven't listened to them already, you may want to check out my previous episodes to learn about the concepts of the science of agroecology. Now, before jumping into this episode, I thought you'd appreciate getting some more background information about agroecology by explaining another one of its attributes. That is, the sources of its knowledge base. For starters, agroecology is a whole systems approach to agriculture and food system development, using the concept of the agroecosystem for its analysis and design. In other words, it's applying systems thinking, where a system can be defined as a cohesive assemblage of interrelated and interdependent parts that is either natural or man-made. Every system is defined by its spatial and temporal boundaries, surrounded and influenced by its environment, described by its structure and purpose or nature, and expressed in its functioning. The whole system approach of agroecology is accomplished with methodologies that are transdisciplinary, participatory, and change-oriented research and action by linking together science, practice, and movements focused on social change. You can learn more about these methodologies in the 2015 edition of Agroecology, The Ecology of Sustainable Food Systems by Steve Gleisman, PhD. Agroecology is an inclusive discipline that engages knowledge sources from many alternative agriculture movements, such as permaculture, sustainable agriculture, regenerative and organic farming, biodynamics, biointensive farming, and others. Agroecology, in its fullest analysis and design, focuses on the three pillars of the social, environmental, and economic basis of sustainability for agriculture and food systems. At the same time, agroecologists around the world do not always agree about what agroecology is or should be in the long term. Definitions of agroecology can be distinguished largely by the specificity with which one defines the term ecology, as well as the term's potential political and economic connotations. These differences can be summarized in the following three approaches for its investigations and applications. 1. Narrowly at the plot or field scales. 2. At the system level, or the agroecosystem and farm scale. And 3. At multiple system levels, that is, the whole community food system. You can learn more about this aspect of the science of agroecology in the 2009 article, Agroecology as a Science, Movement, and Practice, a Review by Alexander Wiesel et al. Examples of agroecological methods and sources of knowledge that contribute to expanding beyond this natural science framework within which the science of agroecology originated include the following: traditional agroecosystems, food system democracy movements, participatory research and education, community food system experiences. For example, traditional agroecosystems provide many examples of how a culture and its local environment have co-evolved with processes that balance the needs of the people expressed as ecological and social economic factors. Many traditional agroecosystems are very sophisticated examples of applications of ecological knowledge. My episodes of Agroecology World will strive to feature practitioners and programs of many of these different methodologies of the science of agroecology. Today's episode introduces you to an academic program of agroecology and sustainable agriculture at Lincoln University near the city of Christchurch on the South Island of New Zealand. It's called the Future Farming Center of the on-campus Biological Husbandry Unit Farm. I was attracted to visiting this institution for the following reasons. One, the Future Farming Center is dedicated to the science and extension of permanent and whole system agricultures and horticultures, such as agroecology, organic agriculture, ecological agriculture, and biological farming for the benefit of all farmers and growers. Two, I read online about their program of indigenous agroecology by one of its staff researchers, Marion Johnson, PhD, who worked with indigenous Maori people to record traditional knowledge of medicinal plants that is rapidly disappearing and which offers exciting potential for low-input ranching technology in the maintenance of livestock health and for promotion of biodiversity in pastures. Three, it operates an organic training college with an on-campus certified organic farm, which is a joint venture between Lincoln University and the New Zealand Organic Movement. Along with the entire biological horticultural unit, it is acknowledged as being inspirational and instrumental for the development of organic agriculture in New Zealand. Four, it offers programs in organic horticulture ranging from a full-time two-year program to standalone part-time courses, as well as extensive ranges of workshops, field days, and a community garden to the general public. The academic program include research, for example, bioprotection, minimum tillage systems, includes farming technique innovation, for example, steam weeding, effective microorganism soil inoculants, and it includes semi-commercial production at the market gardening level. After a short musical interlude, we will listen to a conversation that I had with the current director of the Future Farming Center, Charles Murfield, PhD, aka Murph. He has a diverse background in organic horticulture and agriculture, both managing farms and undertaking research and extension in a range of countries. My visit with Murph at his program location took place in late February 2019. Hello, hello. Welcome to this episode of the podcast Agroecology World. This is your host, Rob Clusen, a.k.a. Dr. K., and I'm sharing with you the voices of the people and the places that are implementing more sustainable food systems using ecology-based best practices and community-based approaches. Today, I'm continuing my travels in New Zealand with a stop at Lincoln University outside the beautiful city of Christchurch on the South Island. I'm visiting the Future Farming Center of the Biological Husbandry Unit of Lincoln University and sitting with Charles Murfield, a.k.a. Murph, the head of this program. So, Murph, if you can, I'd like to introduce your program and center to my listeners, just kind of an overview. I'll have some follow-up questions maybe to probe a little bit deeper into the variety of things. We've just finished a walk, by the way, and it's quite a diversified program out here, but I'm going to let Murph explain all that to you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much. So the BHU is now some 40 years old, and it was established at Lincoln University as an organic unit back in the 1976 under the auspices of a lecturer here called Bob Crowder. And it's continued unbroken since that time. So we're now one of the older organic and ecological units at a university. And we've had a very diverse history. Bob has retired now. We're now a charitable trust, and we're undertaking, continuing as a role of educators, and undertaking a very diverse range of projects, and particularly direct involvement with farmers and growers. So where possible, trying to work with farmers and growers, solving their problems, helping them improve their systems, improve their sustainability.
Murph, I know your background is very diversified, from being a producer to a researcher to consultant. And then I was reading the mission statement for the program, and also I'm interested in how you interpret or use the word agroecology. And I know you also embrace organic farming,
yeah,
and other approaches that are used worldwide to achieve a more sustainable agriculture and food system.
What I've done, there's many different types of the alternative or sustainable agricultures, as I call them. And I've used the word permanent, which I actually stole from Dr. Franklin King's book, Farmers of 40 Centuries, which was one of the foundational texts for organic agriculture. It was published at the end of the 1800s, so it's over a century and a couple of decades old now. And for me, I've come up through organics. I started out as an organic vegetable farmer, and the BHU has been entirely dedicated to organics. But I've seen very much the diversification of farming in terms of looking for alternative approaches. And so now, in certainly in New Zealand, and I think across the world, there's increasing number of farmers saying the system that we've had for the last 50, 70 years isn't working. The farming system that my parents and grandparents farmed under, they're losing confidence in that. And so for me, there's agroecology, there's permaculture, there's organics, there's biodynamics, there's low input farming, and on and on. And even systems such as no-till, I would consider to be one of the alternative agricultures. It has a very specific focus. So for me, I'm very much looking at kind of all these different approaches as a kind of constellation of the alternative agriculture, and I think all of them have valuable lessons. I view organics now to some extent as being this now 70-year-long experiment to answer the question, can we do modern farming without the use of the agrochemicals, the pesticides? And so to me, we look at all these different approaches and see successes, things that haven't worked so well, a few failures. And to me, we need to gather all these very valuable lessons together in terms of working out how we revolutionize farming as a whole, because it's very clear from many voices across science, across international politics, that agriculture needs a complete revolution. So to me, we take all these lessons and we start working out what that revolution is going to look like, because we need to implement it now.
And that answers partially my next question, which is basically, how do you see community working into the center as well as your work? You've just described all of these different approaches across the world, and to me, that's a community of people with similar goals, having maybe different starting points. And we're all converging as we become more knowledgeable and aware about just all the ecological principles that are involved in these approaches. And I did read also on your website, you've got off-site collaborators, international collaborators. Give us a kind of an understanding more about just the breadth of the network that you're working under.
Okay, well, in terms of the collaboration and social size, it's one of the things that I love about farming is it's not just a business like running a manufacturing plant that makes a product. Most farmers live on the farm. The farm is their home, and the farming community is their social community. It's radically different from virtually all the other things. And for me, one of the great failings of a lot of modern agricultural science is this failure to take into account an understanding that farming is as much a social enterprise as it is a business enterprise. And so one of the great joys I have as an academic is having contacts in the farming world, doing consulting and just working with farmer groups. And to me, it's key that we need to build that community around the changes. And then in terms of my research community, having been started my career off as an organic vegetable farmer, I had to deal with all aspects of production, soil management, pests, diseases, weeds. And so very much I'm a generalist, a bit like a general practitioner, a doctor, a medical general practitioner. I cover everything, but then I can't cover everything in depth. So I very much enjoy and need to link up to researchers that have narrow specialities but have the depth. And one of the things I can do is join those people together. Academia, and particularly in agriculture, has become highly siloed. We have researchers that have just spent their entire lives studying soil phosphorus. They know an awful lot about soil phosphorus, but nothing else. But I can join them together, bridge the gaps between them and other soil scientists and then ecologists and all the rest of it. And so that's what I try and do with collaborations, whether we're with Lincoln University just down the road here, or with researchers on the other side of the world, to say, okay, let's bring this expertise together, because this is essential. Under the industrial farming model, we could silo. You could address soil phosphorus on its own. Soil phosphorus is now tied on your weed management and your pest and disease management. These need to be managed through a systematic, integrated, ecological approach. So the scientists need to be working together and talking together and collaborating if we're going to produce the kind of scientific results that are actually going to address the revolution we need in farming.
Well, that's very important what you're talking about. And I guess I also wanted to make sure that some of my listeners understand, because I've met some of your students that are here, mm-hmm. and maybe talk a little bit about the structure of the instructional mm-hmm. college you have here. Is it open to international students? Is it open to international researchers that want to come here to help you achieve some of these goals?
Yep. Yeah, so at the BHU itself, we have a very interesting and sometimes very eclectic range of students, and we've got many mature students here, and they're a great joy to work with. And to me, I always find the students that are interested in the alternative agricultures, they're always very switched on. They're interested in new ideas and new experiences and stuff. So at the moment, we're doing a diploma, and it's open to international students. New Zealand is very welcoming of international students because they have to pay some quite substantial fees. So it is a little bit expensive, but you're very welcome. And for me, for people from the Northern Hemisphere, from the North America, Europe, New Zealand is a really fascinating place to come and do some study of agricultural, just work experience. We're a very similar farming system, but there's some radical differences in New Zealand, particularly its history and its politics, that make this a really useful comparison. So I consider it a very useful place to come for a few months or a year or two to really kind of as much understand your system back home by understanding the differences here. And so that kind of goes on into the research sphere. New Zealand is generally very welcoming of scientists from overseas, particularly with those with agricultural experience. They bring new ideas and cross-fertilization and stuff to New Zealand. And certainly I've had several international interns here myself. And Lincoln University, in terms of both its staff and its students, is a very international university. We're a very small university, only a few thousand students and a few hundred staff, essentially mostly in the middle of the countryside. But we have students and staff here from all corners of the world, all kinds of different backgrounds. So a very international community here.
Well, I hope those of you that might be interested took notes on that. And don't worry, at the end of this broadcast, we'll give you some information on how to get in touch with Murph. Now, one of the things that I like to go over when I'm working with groups that are either mostly not associated with institutions, but still trying to achieve a lot of the goals that you are, that if we look at the strengths of your collaborators or people that have been working here before and maybe not here right now, and then the needs of your community, however you want to define that. You mentioned to me a little bit earlier you're working with some of the Maori community as well as some of the Kiwi community of farmers and agriculturists. And other, you know, things are changing so fast because of many factors. Where you see you can help be as responsive as possible to some of these, and you know, it didn't have to be everything, but maybe a little bit of the priority that you have looking at it that way.
To me, one of the most valuable things I did for my scientific career was to start as a farmer and a grower. So I understand, I've come from that community, I understand what it means to work on the land and till the soil and stand in the middle of a very large field and wondering what to do. So I understand my community and what their needs are. And so a lot of the time what I'm doing is what the community doesn't need is necessarily lots of highbrow, highfalutin research going on. A lot of the time, many of the answers are out there, and then this is where my great fortune in being able to travel internationally and have an international linkages is I can go, I know some guys overseas who solved this problem many years ago, and they've written a really great book. We don't need to do research. I'll get the book, and I'll tell you what it means. So a lot of the time is more just an advising and a consulting role, very simply. And, for example, the Maori growers I'm working with, they were keen to reinstigate growing full stop. Maori are traditionally great cultivators, great gardeners. Many have lost that through the process of colonization. They want to grow back. But they also have a number of crops, and one of them is what's called Maori potatoes, taiwa in Maori. These are heritage potatoes. The most European descendants, the Pākehā, as they're called in New Zealand, no longer grow. And we have a pest over here introduced from the Americas that made growing potatoes without chemicals nearly impossible. But I'd worked on a solution. So I said to these guys, I've got a very simple solution for you. No more research required. I can show you how to grow these crops. We're using these mesh crop covers. Very straightforward approach. Some basic help re-establishing a vegetable production operation. Great success. You know, the many generations of kids and stuff are now coming out and helping in these gardens plant and look after crops. And then the commercial farmers or the Pākehā, the European descended farmers, many of these are running some very substantial, very large businesses, highly technical. But again, most of them have come out of a chemical intensive farming background. They're wanting to reduce herbicide and pesticide use. And so having been in organics, this is the kind of stuff I can say, well, hey, these are the ways we've done this in organics. You know, we can just very simply help you. So taking ideas from one farming system and helping them to translate them in the others. And then occasionally, yep, we come up against a problem. We don't have an off-the-shelf solution. And to me, that's the time to start doing the research. Something practical that we can then find a solution to the farmers and something that they can then take the outputs of and actually implement on their own farm, something practical and doable.
So market forces are a significant factor. Internationally, organic foods, the market is definitely, the trend is growth. Now, how would you describe here in New Zealand the local demand to help, like you say, either more humanely raised or more sustainably raised food products?
Yeah, there's growing interest in organics and alternative farm produce, more humanely produced in New Zealand. It's a lot lower than places like North America and particularly Europe. I mean, in some places in Europe, 20%+ of the farmland is under organic management. In New Zealand, it's only 1%, which is around the global average. And a lot of the time in Europe, that demand for organic and ethically produced food has come from urban centres, from large cities. And New Zealand's been a very rural country. Virtually everybody's lived in the countryside until the last 20 years. We're now seeing large urbanisation, and certainly our urban consumers, and certainly the younger generation, the millennials, they're really interested in how their food's produced. Previous generations really weren't concerned. As long as the food was in the supermarket, that was fine. Younger generations are asking the harder questions now and are interested in this. So we're seeing a growth in demand for organics within New Zealand. New Zealand farming as a whole is very odd in the fact that virtually the entire produce of New Zealand is exported. We grow enough food for 40 million people, but there's only 5 in New Zealand. So food for 35 million people is all exported. That's a lot of food. And so for organics in New Zealand, only about a third of the organic crops grown in New Zealand is actually consumed here. The other two-thirds are exported. But for some New Zealand non-organic crops, for example, milk, 95% of the milk produced in New Zealand is all exported. Only 5% is actually consumed here. So organics in New Zealand is certainly growing. There's strong interest now from the government in helping grow the sector. They see that it aligns very much with where food needs to go in terms of sustainability, ethics, particularly increasing the amount of plant components of the diet. New Zealand has a history of producing red meat and a lot of dairy products, but organics is much more diversified than that as well. So it's certainly growing demand here.
Murph, is there a growing demand for urban agriculture? And you said you have urbanization happening in New Zealand. In Australia, I was able to visit some city farm projects, and I just wanted to follow up on what's the status here in New Zealand.
Yep, there certainly is a growing interest. The BHU here is involved in a group in Christchurch City called Regenerate Christchurch and the Food Resilience Network. 8 years ago, Christchurch was devastated by a series of very large earthquakes. And so we essentially almost had a clean slate for rebuilding. And so urban agriculture has become a very important part of that, making use of essentially sites that used to be buildings and are now essentially vacant lots. And certainly in other cities, Wellington and Auckland, again, these are often being led by urbanites. Principally, I'm involved in a project called For the Love of Bees up in Auckland. It's being led by an artist. So really fascinating working with a community of artists in this case that I've never interacted with before. And certainly if I was just a standard agricultural scientist, I never would do. So it's not one of my particular areas, but there's certainly a growing interest. But it's certainly compared to other countries that have a lot larger cities. I mean, for Auckland, for example, is our largest city, and it has only barely a million people in it. So in a lot of places, that would barely be a town. So we are urbanizing, but not in the level that we see overseas. And also in New Zealand, until recently, as I said before, most people had linkages to the land. Most people were involved with farming at some level, or an uncle or an aunt or their parents came from a farm. So people didn't need that feed. It's only now we're seeing in more recent years that we have people in cities that have no connection with farming and that are feeling that loss. And therefore we're seeing, you know, the urban farming movement really starting to pick up and take off in New Zealand.
Very interesting. Well, now I always like to flip the coin, so to speak, and that is all groups, all programs have needs. It can be skill sets, it can be, a variety of things. And you can look at that internally and then maybe threats externally for your program to not only succeed, but to expand. And again, wondering, what is the situation that you have, and what are the high priority ones that you've recognized you need to address? You need to keep trying to figure out how to turn things around a little bit so that this program can flourish.
Oh, that's a big question. To me, kind of, it's going back to some of those earlier comments. We really need a brand new agricultural revolution. We essentially need to undo the entire direction of intensive agriculture that we've been heading down for the last 70 years and reinvent agriculture almost from the ground up again, which is really just a task of jaw-dropping immensity. I mean, people talk about kind of Marshall plans and moonshots and this kind of stuff, and people are actually starting to talk about all those massive programs from post the Second World War all rolled into one in terms of the size of the challenge ahead of us. So it really is jaw-dropping. And to me, there's kind of no one thing. I mean, I have a particular interest in weed management and non-chemical weed management, and so I've got a passion in there, and particularly thermal weeding, kind of getting really specialised. But in terms of the blockages, there's the usual science bugbear of funding, which is there's never enough funding to do anything. But moving beyond that, to me, it's curious that at an international level, in the likes of the UN and the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, at those very highest levels, they're very clear of the need for massive change in agriculture. They are. The head of the FAO talks about paradigm shifts in agriculture. But for me, looking across the world at the national political level, to me, that's where the blockage is. I see virtually no national governments really showing any understanding of the need or the size of the challenge that faces us. And one of the key points, we face these massive global challenges of climate change and biodiversity loss, not nutrient pollution from nitrogen and phosphorus. All of these things are linked through to agriculture. So the World Wildlife Fund recently had an exercise where they said, okay, how much wildlife have we saved? And the answer was none. They said, what actually causes all the wildlife loss across the world? And there was one answer, agriculture. So agriculture is fundamentally at the heart of all the global problems we face, all these big things like climate change and biodiversity. So if we're going to fix those, we have to fix agriculture. So to me, once we fix agriculture, we're actually home and dry. Until we fix agriculture, we have some serious problems ahead of us. So to me, it's very clear what we need to do. What we need is the political understanding and the will to empower farmers and agricultural researchers and the extension agents, the whole agricultural community, to actually set sail on this new course that we need to get onto.
Yes, it does seem like a daunting challenge for all of us in this field, and yet we pursue, be persistent, and we can only keep on knowing more about what each other is doing, growing, you know, taking inspiration in that, which I'm sure these listeners will from hearing your story. But there is one question left that I couldn't help but asking, because it's a great play on words. If you had to sum up, what's the future of your future farming center?
The hard question for last. The future of the Future Farming Centre is farmers and growers. This is what this place is here for. It's to help those good folk out in the fields, working hard, making a income, putting a roof and over their families' heads and keeping them fed. That's the reason why I'm here. Those are the people I'm here to help. So if those guys are thriving, I'm thriving.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Murph. I really, really enjoyed spending the afternoon with you and coming to your research center here and learning more about the scope and the aspirations of your program. And I just wish you all the success that can possibly happen for it. So right now, after a short musical interlude, I will wrap up this podcast.
Well, there you have it, my conversation with Murph from the Future Farming Center of Lincoln University in Christchurch, New Zealand. Done when my wife Skye and I visited the spectacular and wild South Island of New Zealand. I hope that you found it as informative and as inspiring as I did. If you want further information about Lincoln University's Future Farming Center, and their academic programs, as well as to contact MRF, please check out their website at www.bhu.org.nz/futuree-faring-cntre/. And if you want further information about their Indigenous Agroecology Program, please refer to their website at www.maramata.co.nz/project/indignous-agroecology. For your information, I was unable to interview Marian Johnson about this Indigenous Agroecology Program because now she's working at the Elm Farm Organic Research Center in the UK. I plan to meet and interview her when my world travels take me and my wife to the UK. Meanwhile, to contact her, see the website www.organicresearchcentre.com. And last but not least, I again want to acknowledge the artists of my theme music selections for this episode of Agroecology World. That is the song Once Again by the group Hang Massive, and the song Everyone Sleeps in the Light by Joaquin Cooter. Happy trails until we meet again at my next episode of Agroecology World from another stop in my world travels. I really appreciate everyone's efforts in becoming regular listeners and spreading the word about Agroecology World podcast. It's continuing to expand in its reach with a growing number of listeners, which is a wonderful thing.